look at you and suddenly something in your eyes I see soon begins bewitching me. It's that old double moon that you stole from the skies. It's that old double moon in your eyes.
You are listening to Stumptown Trade Review, your online resource for independent comics. I'm Brian.
And I'm Thor.
You can catch us on iTunes or at our blog, stumptowntradereview.blogspot.com. We're also on Twitter and MySpace. And tonight we are looking at two books. We're looking at The Darkness from Warsaw, A Tale of the SQRL. It's by Bram Meehan and Jamie Chase. It is from Panel Press. We're also taking a look at Anna Mercury, Volume 1 by Warren Ellis and Facundo Percio from Avatar. I think we're going to go ahead and start with The Darkness from Warsaw. It is a bookend tale, if you will, where it's framed by a modern day piece where an old woman is visited by someone who lets us know that she has a past with a paranormal research division, if you will, of the British government, and he is coming to her with some information about a long past case of hers, a panel from a piece of art stolen during World War II from Warsaw. And so the bulk of the story takes place in the past as she relates the story to the person who's come to visit her. Does that pretty much cover it?
I think so, yeah.
So, overall, what was your feeling on this?
I thought that this was a really boring story. There's just no highlights in it for me. I felt like it started out boring, and it got even worse once they got into the supernatural side of it, and they didn't even explain that. It was just sort of, oh, this event happened, and that's it.
I really felt like there was so much more that could have been told with this. The author and the artist could have really upped the drama aspect of it. I mean, you have people going into occupied territory. They're going into Warsaw at the end of during the Cold War. They're going into Warsaw and are attempting to return a sacred object that everybody seems to want to get their hands on. So it seems like you could really do some great things with this, but they don't, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, I felt like there was no buildup of drama or tension. There was just, at any point in this was I on pins and needles waiting to find out what was going to happen. It just started out very dry. They didn't pique my... there was no piquing of the interest about what was this event in the past. It was just sort of blah.
Right. Well, and also I think what took away from a lot of tension was the fact that we already know that she survives.
Yeah.
Because we see her in the future at the beginning of this story. So that's a bit of a problem there. And maybe that took away from it as well. I think that, a different writer could have found a different angle to take this. I know that Greg Rucka has done a lot of work in his Queen and Country stories where you have agents dropped behind enemy lines, and even if there's no guns fired, nobody captured, there still is this tension and drama there that you can really feel.
Yeah.
And Meehan just didn't capture any of that. He almost relied on our own feelings about the Cold War, our own perceptions to make that happen, instead of building it into the story itself.
Sure, yeah, that's I'd say that's totally accurate.
And while you might be able to do that in different situations, such as were you to put it in World War II and in Nazi Germany, you know, Nazis evoke a different emotional response in most people than Cold War Russia.
Yeah.
And you can add a little bit, you can rely on people's perceptions a little bit more if you choose a more terrifying antagonist. But in this, even that, they weren't even necessarily an antagonist. The fact that it was Cold War Poland was a background issue and a setting issue.
Yeah.
Far less than it was, you know, I mean, it was more of that than it was an antagonist. I'm not even sure who the antagonists were in this.
Yeah, did we ever even see them? Because when they get off the train in Warsaw, they're followed by some people, but they end up being the people that they want to meet with eventually. And you're just, they're sort of the shadowy people that might be following them, but might not. And there was really no suspense at all.
Yeah, and it ended up being a big to-do about nothing.
Yeah, and they were followed for, like, maybe a page, two right. pages. It was like, this happened, oh, but it wasn't really.
Right. And there was a little bit of an allusion to the fact that they weren't necessarily being chased as much as they were being led.
Yeah.
But even then, you know, that's once again just taking away from the drama of the situation. You are once again telling us, oh, there wasn't really ever anything to worry about.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I felt like every time they started to build drama, it got swept away really quick.
Yeah.
So, what about the pacing then? I mean, you said that it never really piqued your interest. Was this book, I mean, did it go too fast, too slow? I mean, was there something that could have been done to this, do you think?
Yeah, I think it was definitely too fast. It was just sort of like, I mean, there should have been drama built up about how they were getting back into Poland without any notice. And it was just sort of, they were on the train and, oh, they think they picked up a tail. Mm-hmm. But then it ended up not being a tail. And right. So I felt like that should have been the most dramatic moment in the book. Was them trying to get back into Poland, and maybe once they were in Poland, you know, having problems or whatever. But there was none of that. And the supernatural aspect of it, it's never really explained. There's no what was going on. I mean, there was a little bit of old gods talk in it, but not enough to really make you understand what was going on. It was like a very poorly done courtyard, you know. It was like right. that same kind of idea that just had no execution whatsoever.
Right.
It was just,
and I'm with you. I think that if they would have had more pages, I think they could have told a better story. They tried to cram everything into 48 pages, and I think that if they would have gone for like a 64 page comic or 72 page comic, where you could have had, you know, 20 some odd pages of the setup and the getting into Poland, the middle piece being all the tension building of being in Poland and trying to find the contact and trying to figure out where to return this and being chased by somebody, I mean a real somebody, to put a real antagonist in there. And then the last third of the book, the last 20, 25 pages, then you can have your resolution, you can have your supernatural reveal, if you will, and you will have something invested in the characters.
I think the worst part was when you get to the end of the book. So it starts out that this mysterious figure comes to the protagonist, Estelle, as an old lady, and asks her about this event. So then it immediately brings you back and they go through the tale of the event. And then the book ends bringing us back to present time, with this mysterious figure basically saying, oh, thanks for telling me that, later.
Yeah, and he gives her a vial with a piece of this piece in it. And I'm not sure if that is supposed to make us feel like, oh, wait, there's more story coming as she now has to return this. I didn't get a feeling like there was any reason behind him giving it to her and that there was any reason why it should be important.
Yeah. Yeah, there was pretty much just nothing but letdown. Like, no buildup, but just constant letdown.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it's hard to describe, but this story just was not a good one.
No. How'd you feel about the art?
I actually really liked the art. I think this is one of the best black and white treatments that I've seen in a while. And I really liked it. It looks like it was inked and then bled out to make like the grays and
mm-hmm.
So it was like water and ink. And I really liked it. I thought that it was well executed.
See, I had a problem with it. I felt that it was too blocky in it, that everything, there was very little variance in line width, that if it was black, it was a big, fat, chunky black, and there was no variation to it, meaning that everybody got, and everything got this sort of weird, distorted, almost, you know, harsh light, but from the side. You know, if you take a flashlight and you stick it under your chin and how it really distorts your face because of all the weird shadows, or, you know, off to the side, how it'll really distort your face. I kind of got a feeling that that's what this was in the art, that it was a lot of just distorted light. And I know that the artist was going for kind of that 1950s early Hitchcock noir feel. In fact, in the back there is one of the alternate covers. There's a note, it says a more impressionistic approach with a classic horror feel. And I think that's more of what they were going for. But I just don't necessarily feel like all the skill was there. I feel like, you know, the intent was there, but it just lacked the skill and tools to do it.
See, I think it was a stylistic choice to do it that way, and I think that it did work with the story, and I actually liked it. One of the things is that I never had a problem discerning what character was who. That design was really well done.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that he did pull off a really noirish look and feel for the story. And that was really the only thing that kept me turning the page. Really, if I didn't have to do this review, I probably would have dropped this book in the middle and not read the rest of it.
Yeah, I don't know. I can handle big inks. You know, I remember being a kid and seeing Jimmy Palmiotti's inks over Joe Quesada's art, and how you had just big patches of black where faces would be, or bodies or arms, and then looking at, you know, Mike Mignola's work on Hellboy with the you know, all the darkness and big blacks there. And, you know, when it's done right, it works, and it's so powerful, and it really works to create a mood. And just for me, I feel it falls short. There were a couple of places where I thought it was really striking, and it did work, kind of with the Elder Gods, where you have this sort of Hawkman-type person slaying a serpent, if you will. I thought that worked really well, but again, I felt like it was more of a dramatic lighting piece than it was.
Sure, but what I think works really well with it is the use of the gray tones and the grayscale in it. If it would have just been straight black and white, I think that I would agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
But really, the use of the grays in so many panels, I think, really sets this apart from other pieces that are like it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that's where it works. And I think that it really worked well showing when Petrie gets possessed by this supernatural force or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that looked really cool and looked like something was happening to him. Something unnatural.
Right. So, what about the dialogue and characterization? Did you find it believable? And, I mean, you said that visually you didn't have a problem telling the characters apart. And I agree. I thought that they were all visibly discernible. How about the dialogue?
I had a real problem when they went into Warsaw and some of the people are talking in a foreign dialect accent or whatever. And
this way to come you please or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, right. Exactly. And then some of them aren't. They're just speaking regularly.
Right.
And there was just a lot of problems with the dialogue. There really isn't that much dialogue throughout this book. Most of it's an inner monologue,
mm-hmm.
it seemed like. But it was just so bland.
Mm-hmm. I think that you've hit on it about it being an inner monologue, that a lot of times modern comics avoid the narrative text box. You know, avoid telling us what's going on in the scene, relying heavily on the art to do the work. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And I think that this is one where having those narration boxes did help push the story along.
Sure.
It did help clarify where things were and how things were happening. But you're right. I mean, it wasn't necessarily that it added to anybody's characterization. And I didn't feel like the characterization was really there. I didn't feel like any of these characters were anything special, that there was a reason why you would choose Estelle White or this Norris guy over any other people in the, you know, in this special bureau.
Yeah.
So.
There was no characterization as far as I'm concerned. Really, you could swap characters around and there was no difference, you mm-hmm. know, like there was nothing different about any of these characters, and I really couldn't care less about what happened to Petrie. He ends up disappearing in the end, and I really don't even care why or how it happened.
Okay, the one character that I thought was kind of cool shows up for what, two pages? Three? The magician.
Oh, yeah.
I thought the magician was visually striking.
Yep.
I thought, you know, I kind of expected them to just go kind of the Doctor Strange version and have some guy sitting in a room meditating, hovering 3 feet off the ground and with a big cloak and all sorts of, you know, potions bubbling. And no, it's just a really creepy looking guy with glowing eyes and a fedora standing and talking to her. But it's not even clear that he's talking. I almost got the feeling like his voice was in her mind.
Yeah.
And then he disappears. And I thought that character was great. And, you know, there was an allusion to the fact that these wizards were somehow, somehow tied to the government in some way, that there had been a long-standing agreement between the two. That's another story I would be interested in seeing, is how does a group of old magic wizards end up working with a government agency and then have a falling out because it says they don't officially work with them anymore.
I don't know if I would if it's written by Bram Meehan.
Yeah.
I'm not real impressed with what he shows us in this book.
Now, before this, you and I were talking about how the supernatural piece was almost a turnoff for you, that you thought that the idea of taking artifacts and returning them to, you know, their homeland.
Yeah.
It was a much more interesting story. And in the back, it says that there's a note on the back cover. Note, the Monuments, Fine Arts, and Archives section of the U.S. Army was a real and often overlooked part of World War II history. A nonfiction graphic novel recounting their importance in the resource and restoration of Europe's cultural histories in development from Panel Press. What about that? Would you be interested in seeing something like that? A story about these soldiers trying to return it?
I think that that would be interesting. I'm not sure that I would buy it if it's, again, written by Bram Meehan. I might pick it up in the library or borrow somebody's copy. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'd drop down the money on this author again. He'd have to really do something that I heard about that was good before I'm going to take a chance on him again.
I think that for me, what brought this book home for me, it just sounds strange, it was the price point. The book was $6.95, which I feel like there is a really solid niche in that, you know, $7 to $8 range where you can get potentially a really good story, 48 pages or so of good story in that $7 to $8 range. I mean, last week's book, The Courtyard, was in that range.
Pulled it off.
And, you know, I know that we keep talking about how comic book prices are going up and up and up for the floppy books. You know, the monthlies, they're up to basically $4 an issue now. I think that there really is a solid market for, if they could turn out a quality product, for this $7 to $8 range where you get, you know, 2.5 issues, maybe 3 issues worth of material in a nice cover, a little bit of back matter for you, some bonuses thrown in.
Yeah.
So, you know, at $6.95, this was a, you know, that's really what helped bring it home. I really wouldn't have brought this home at $10 or $11.
Oh, definitely.
And if I would have, I would have felt really bad about it afterwards. Yeah. So, yeah, there you go, publishers. $6.95. It'll at least get someone to pull it off the shelf and give it a shot.
Yeah.
So, moving on, Anna Mercury by Warren Ellis and Facundo Percio. If I've blown it, I'm sorry. This is a science fiction piece involving alternate Earths that are in orbit around our own, just off the space-time continuum. And they've been orbiting there, well, for as long as anyone's known. And eventually, the governments of the Earth figured out how to transport people and machines between the worlds. And what ends up happening is they accidentally set up a cargo cult on one of these worlds. Excuse me. And so it is the job of the secret agent Anna Mercury, among others, to kind of keep an eye on this planet, this sort of mini Earth outside of our space-time, to make sure, to basically be a caretaker and keeper of it, to make sure that things don't get entirely out of control. I think that's the best way to put it. It's kind of a convoluted plot. It's got some real potential.
Yeah.
I like this idea of these alternate worlds orbiting outside of our space and time that, you know, secret agents can sort of pop into and out of as needed.
And hats off to Warren Ellis and Facundo for bringing us our first transsexual superhero. If that's not a tranny, I don't know what is, with the big fake wig and...
Dude, she's not a transsexual.
The man face. Dude, if she isn't, that's just horrible art.
Okay, she squats to pee.
That doesn't mean anything.
It totally... She squats to pee. Where they give us the gratuitous ass shot.
Yeah.
It has to be.
I'm not buying it.
Her name is Anna Louise Britton. It's her secret agent name.
Yeah, I'm not buying it.
That's not a drag queen name. Anna Mercury.
I didn't say drag queen.
Is a drag queen tranny name.
I said transsexual.
So, overall feel, what did you
big
think?
Big fake wig. Come on, how can you deny it?
Big fake wig. Total go-go boots.
Go-go boots. The big square jaw and chin.
All right, but that's an art thing. I mean, you take a look at some of the covers in the back. I don't know, her breasts do get bigger as when she's in costume, don't they?
It's true.
I don't know.
I'm just calling it how I see it.
You're calling it how you see it. So, outside of your lack of sexual attraction to her, what did you think about this?
The story was all right, passable. Really, for Warren Ellis, though, I don't think it hits. You expect a little bit more out of Warren Ellis. Maybe for somebody else, this would have been a good story. But I feel like I've read Warren Ellis stuff that is just really good, really powerful, and has really cool ideas. And this has some of those cool ideas, but I feel like it kind of misfires at points during this story.
I feel like this really requires a second reading. And it's not a requires a second reading in the way that Watchmen requires a second reading. It's not a second reading, you know, it's not a required second reading in the way that The Courtyard requires a second reading, where you're going back where it was like, wow, that was so incredible. I want to go back and pick up the clues, or I want to go and pick up what was going on in the background. This requires a second reading because the plot just is not clear.
Yeah.
And I think it comes down to the pacing. I think that the pacing of this was off. So much of this was set up in the first... I should take that back. So little of this was set up in the first issue. The whole first issue is one big elaborate chase.
Mm-hmm.
And it really isn't until midway through the second where we start to get any concept of what's really going on here. And by that time, you know, we're a third of the way through the series and we have no... I mean, we're just starting to get a clue as to what's going on, or at least the science behind what's going on. And then we start to see the politics, but again, it's one of those things where there's so much information that is required to understand what's going on that to waste all of it up front, or to waste all that upfront time by not going into it, means that you're spending half of your time wondering what the heck's going on when you should be enjoying the big chase scene.
Yeah.
You know, the chase scene was pretty dramatic. It really was, but I spent all my time wondering what the hell Atraxia was and the Mandragon Moon and Shoal and, you know, a gun, and how is a gun going to cut something off? And, I mean, there was all these concepts there that eventually almost get explained.
Yeah.
But so... you're so far into it and you're so confused that it takes a while to wrap your brain around it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
And I mean, I read the first two issues of this in, you know, monthly installment. Because, I mean, I've said it before, I'm a big Warren Ellis fan. Anything he writes, I go out and grab. And so I read the first two, and it was confusing as all get out. And, you know, I stopped reading it because I realized that I had to wait until I had the whole story in my hand.
Yeah.
There was just no way that I was going to figure this out in a monthly installment.
Yeah, you'd have to go back and reread it each issue every time you got a new issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I have to say, though, one of the places where he really knocks it out of the park, and this just shows you what an experienced writer has over an inexperienced one, is when she jumps on the ship and the ship takes off, and then it ends with her trying to like pry open a door or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes into the launch pad station with the people that are overseeing her mission, sort of like a NASA control room.
Uh-huh.
Then the whole next page is all of them being discussing her situation and what's going on, and, you know, how is she going to make it? Is she going to make it? The whole next page is that. And then the bottom of that page is seeing her with ice on her face, trying to pry it open. And then she finally gets in. And that built up so much tension in me, like, because you're not seeing what she's doing. You're just listening to people's reactions to what's going on. And I was thoroughly impressed with those several pages in here. That was something that really worked and showed you what Warren Ellis can do really well.
Yeah, there are some great moments in here that just make you appreciate the writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, as much as the star of this was Anna Mercury, what really made it click was all of the support system that was in place to, you know, to get her to do what it is she does. It's almost like the whole aircraft carrier approach, where it takes 6,000 or 7,000 people to launch 24 airplanes off of an aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
And it's the same kind of idea that while this is called Anna Mercury, and it is about Anna Mercury, there's all these other characters, like you said, almost a NASA ground control, that have to keep everything going. And that's where the real tension and drama comes in.
I thought the other cool thing was that he really limits her powers. She's almost all powerful, except for that she only has a certain amount at each time that she's in this world. And so that made it really cool and adds a sense of tension that you wouldn't get out of, say, a Superman superhero, you know?
Right, and the loss of power is, you know, it's fatal.
Yeah.
That what keeps her on this alternate Earth is this power level that she's given.
And if I think they call it an anchor point,
right. And if she doesn't, she, what they call boomerangs, which is basically she comes rocketing back to Earth and explodes
up, yeah.
So you're right, it does add a kind of time limit to this that's always ticking in the background, that for her to do these things limits her time there, and it could be fatal.
Sure, and the more that she does, the more aggressive she gets with her powers, the more it drains how much time she has there. I think that was a really cool concept for them. Another really cool concept was the idea that this whole world only had two cities. And one was like this uber religious, fanatical city and society. And the other one had no religion whatsoever. And it was sort of the clash between those two cities was a really interesting idea for me. And that's just one world. There's, mm-hmm. what, eight or nine more.
Yeah.
Worlds beyond that. And I think that that's what could be really cool is Warren Ellis's explaining of what each one of those other worlds is like and the dynamics that rule them.
What I thought, you know, to play off that a little bit more, what I thought was so fascinating, and again, this is a really high quality writer here, is that he took two concepts and mashed them together. On the one hand, he took an ultra high tech futuristic society in this Atraxia and mashed it with an incredibly low-tech, almost primitive cargo cult concept.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So that, you know, cargo cults are, you know, something that develop in isolated parts of the world when an indigenous society comes into brief contact with something much higher advance. A lot of South Pacific islands developed cargo cults during World War II, when airplanes would come and crash on their island or drop, you know, cargo on the island. And, you know, the inhabitants, to deal with it, would sort of create a religious movement out of it. So you have, on the one hand, this high-tech, highly advanced society with a very low-tech, you know, low level of religious advancement,
sure.
mashed together, which is a great juxtaposition.
And it's all based off of that conspiracy about the World War II ship that teleported or whatever, mm-hmm. right? I've heard this on Coast to Coast before. And so basically, this ship teleported and then disappeared for a certain amount of time and then came back, and there was like sailors like stuck in the metal and all sorts of horrific things, like they just got welded into the metal when it came back. And I mean, this is, you know, a giant conspiracy theory about whether or not this even happened, but it takes that idea. So this ship appeared in this other world, and then that's where the cargo cult came from, was that idea.
And I think that that lended some real credence, because I couldn't figure out why this society would go about building us this, you know, massive super gun.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until, you know, later on when Ellis laid it out, and again, this is one of those later on things that, you know, by this time we're so far into it. But once he explains it, it makes perfect sense that if, you know, your religion is based around a god who gave you something and then took it away, and to appease your god, you want to build something to worship him, well, God brought a giant gun and then left. So you build bigger guns and bigger guns and bigger guns to try to entice him back. And then you start to look for, well, this isn't working. Why not? These people don't believe. So the again, heretics, it makes sense. And again, you get this technology and religion mashing together, and it shouldn't work, but it does.
Yeah.
Once it's explained and laid out. And I think that if you would have pasted a little bit different, it would have been a much more cohesive piece, because there's so many good ideas in here, and you almost get a little bit of the you know, old Fantastic Four. I mean, we're talking really old Fantastic Four here, where there was a group of Skrulls who had found an escaped gangster and had brought him back to their world, and so they based their entire society, or the planet that they were inhabiting, on this gangster. And so everything was this 1930s feel to it, with these ray guns. So you almost get the same thing here, where all the cars on this planet of Atraxia kind of have a 1940s look and feel to them as well. And the clothing as well, the people that she's coming into contact with on this planet, they too have this sort of 1940s look to them in their clothing. So you get that sort of feel too, where it's not just that this society is building the gun, but this society is almost building their own version of 1940s.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there was some really cool things that hit, and it was just too convoluted to just make it really good.
And unfortunately, I don't think the art did it any favors. I mean, besides the fact that you can make a really credible argument for the fact that we have the world's first, you know, interdimensional transvestite, a superhero, there were some parts where I really just didn't get what was happening on the page. And I think that, you know, we could have used a kind of narrative box up there with the, you know, flight control commander explaining to the prime minister what was going on. You know, when she boomerangs out after crashing the lifter into the gun, there's this thing where she's just sort of floating in space, and I think she can see all the worlds, but then she looks down and now there's, I don't know what it is.
Yeah, there were several panels like that. They were just really confusing and didn't explain the action at all. And this is a problem that I have with a lot of superhero comics, is that the dialogue can't really explain what's going on, because there's no words that really explain what is happening. So it should be up to the artist at that point to give you a feel of what's going on. And one of them is when they're talking about how she absorbed all that energy and then like kind of blew it out or made a bubble or right. something to destroy all the soldiers around her. And it just wasn't well done. I didn't understand really what it was that she was doing, except for that she was just using some sort of power to explode bodies.
Right.
And it, this is such a high technology book that it would have been cool to understand exactly what was happening, because almost everything else has been explained so well about why she can do these powers or use these powers. And so it really fell down in that sequence.
Right. And that's one, again, that's where the writer should have stepped in and said something. Warren Ellis is really good at giving us either the science or the pseudoscience behind what's happening. And if he's going to take a step back, then the artist has to be right there to go with it. And he just wasn't. And like I said, I just felt like there were so many places in this book where we needed clearer storytelling. We needed, in the art sense, we needed clearer artistic storytelling. And again, there were some neat parts to it as well. But for the most part, I would have chosen a more capable artist for this.
Definitely. I still don't understand really how she blew up the gun in the first or second time.
Right.
It's not explained. There's no dialogue telling us what she did or tried to do. And the art is just chaotic. It shows nothing at all, almost.
Right.
So I had a really big problem with the art in this book.
And I think that there was, you know, it's almost like they didn't quite go far enough in a few places as well with the art, that, you know, there's a comment that she makes to the Prime Minister where she said, I think it was to the Prime Minister, where she says that if you saw her, would you really believe that she was real?
Yeah.
You know, and it's like that, you know, the big go-go boots and the big red hair and, you know, black leather and all this. You know, you almost want something that just is almost otherworldly. I mean, almost that Matrix feel. You know, when how the characters in the Matrix looked and felt and acted and moved like they were just one step above everybody else. I wanted a little bit more of that from her.
I agree with you.
So, this was a $20 book.
Yeah.
I'm having a little bit of trouble with that. Because, you know, the $20 book, the bar has been raised.
Yeah.
Welcome to Hawksford has forever raised the $20 price point for me.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, I cannot think of a better $20 I've spent on a comic book than Welcome to Hawksford.
Sure.
So anything I read is now going to have to go against that. And unfortunately, $20 for this was a bit much.
Yeah, definitely. I feel that really publishers have seen that the wave of the future is going to be graphic novels. Mm-hmm. You know, people are going to collect the issues when they come out, but mostly people are going to come and look at a back catalog and pick up graphic novels. They're not going to be picking up issues. Mm-hmm. And so they're really raising the prices on all of the books, and it's keeping pace with the prices of the issues. It used to be that when you bought a graphic novel, you got a deal, you know. Right. It was less than if you had bought all the issues. And I feel like in the past 4-6 months, it's changed to where you're spending more now than you would per issue if you bought this in just the issue form.
Well, I think that this was, what, 6 issues?
5.
5 issues.
So that makes $4 an issue.
Which is what it would have been in, you know, in your store. So, yeah. I don't know.
And I mean, you get the covers in the back, mm-hmm. but honestly, I don't really care about covers
unless as much as, really special. Exactly. But right.
Unless I'd rather have a lower price point.
I agree. And, you know, I think that for me, you know, Warren Ellis is a frustrating writer for me in that I either love what he writes or I really hate what he writes. And there's not a whole lot of room in between. This is only the second book I've picked up of his where I'm like, eh, I could go either way.
Yeah.
The hard part is that the last book I read by him was Etheric Mechanics. It was $6.99.
Yeah.
It was 48 pages, and it was awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, it was fantastic. I felt the same way about that book that I felt about The Courtyard.
Yeah.
That it really told a full, complete story. It was Warren Ellis firing on all pistons, and it was great.
Yeah.
Then I pick this up. It's $20. The art's okay. The story has a great concept, but the execution is off.
Sure. I almost feel like I got more story out of Etheric Mechanics than I did in this, which is kind of surprising because this is 4 times as big almost.
Yeah, it's definitely much larger. And yeah, it's not nearly the quality of the story.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know.
Will you pick up Volume 2?
I don't know that I'm necessarily going to pick up Volume 2 right off the shelf, you know, and see, okay, you know, this is it, you know, gotta have it. You know, I chose this over Challenger Deep.
Yeah.
Because it was Warren Ellis, and I was excited, and I wanted to read it, and it was the Anna Mercury story that I knew that once it was all together, I would understand it. And now I feel kind of let down, especially at $20. At, you know, $15, $16, I might feel a little better about it. Like you said, if I was getting a deal on it, if my patience would have been rewarded, I think I would have felt a little bit better about this. But, you know, Anna Mercury Volume 2, I'll pick it up. I will. Because, you know, like you said, there's a whole bunch of other worlds out there, and figuring out what she does on other worlds, fantastic. Great idea.
I think once that we've gotten over that hurdle of understanding what's going on, I think mm-hmm. that it could be really cool from here on out.
Right. But this one, yeah, there should have been a lot of expository work up front on this, and there wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully this will be the expository piece, and the next one can be something more interesting and exciting. This was interesting and exciting. Something that is more coherent and cohesive.
Yeah.
Paced a little better.
And I think that what he was trying to do is not give exposition purely for exposition. And so he was playing with that when he'd release it and how he would release it so that it would feel natural. And it mm-hmm. did feel natural coming from the characters, but it left you confused going through.
Right. So, you know, I think what I'm going to do to make myself feel a little bit better is I'm going to go home and I am going to read book 2 of Freak Angels, which I don't know if you have been reading Freak Angels, but Warren Ellis publishes every week 6 pages for free online, an ongoing comic called Freak Angels. A lot of fun, great comic, and like I said, it's free. And then after he publishes a certain number of pages online, he collects it into a floppy book, and you can go and buy it. But like I said, it's for free online, 6 pages a week. So I think I'm going to go and get my free dose of Warren Ellis to sort of make up for the $20 I spent here. And I'll break even in the end, because I've been feeling pretty guilty about getting such a high-quality comic for free. So I guess it all works out.
Well, I think you've paid it forward with Anna Mercury.
All right. Well, you have been listening to Stumptown Trade Review. Once again, you can find us on iTunes at our blog at stumptowntradereview.blogspot.com. You can follow us on Twitter. We are Stumptown at Twitter and on MySpace.
that you stole from the skies. It's that old level moon in your eyes. You and your glance make this romance too hot to handle. Stars in the night, blazing their light, can't hold a candle to your razzle-dazzle. You've got me flying high and wide on a magic carpet ride full of butterflies inside. Wanna cry, wanna croon, wanna laugh like a loon. It's that old level moon in your eyes. Just when I think I'm free as a dove, old level moon deep in your eyes blinds me with love. Magic carpet ride full of butterflies inside. Wanna cry, wanna croon, wanna laugh like a loon. It's that old level moon in your eyes. Just when I think I'm free as a dove, old level moon deep in your eyes blinds me